You're listening to the NetMums podcast with me, Wendy Gollidge.
And me, Alison Perry.
Welcome, everyone. I'm on my own this week because my co-host, Wendy, is poorly. So get well soon, Wendy, if you're listening. And as we established last week, she's a bit of a Christmas Grinch. And I'm worried that I might be joining her on that one because it's only mid-November and the Christmas overwhelm has started already. I'm just feeling like it's a lot to try and plan in all of the fun stuff for the kids in December, rehearsing for the nativity, booking the panto visits, getting tickets for Santa's grotto, and crucially, not over-planning to make sure that your kids and you don't get overtight and grumpy. It's just a lot. But I'm betting that our guest today has Christmas nailed, not least because his kids have grown up. So I'm guessing he's not in the thick of it anymore. We're joined today by Martin Kemp, founding member of 80s pop group Spandau Ballet, TV and film actor, presenter, and now the author of his first novel, The Game. Martin, welcome to the NetMums podcast.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me. And listen, I am right in the thick of Christmas. You know, I this is the honest truth. I have been in the thick of Christmas since the summer, right? Because, well, I think I've done about three Christmas drama specials.
Right.
Since the summer. And all of those Christmas ones are filmed during the, you know, the hottest part of the year.
Do they have, like, the fake snow that they put out?
Yeah, I've dressed up as Father Christmas about three times so far. but it's so much fun, you know. But listen, my wife absolutely loves Christmas.
Does she? Do you go quite big in the Kemp household?
Oh, yeah, we always have done. But we have everybody over to our house. So, yeah, it's really nice. We have a lot of fun at Christmas. You know what? It gets dark early. It's cold. You've got to have something to look forward to.
Yes.
Christmas is like spring with the flowers coming out, but just winter.
That's so true. A bit of sparkle to the evenings. It's good. Now, Martin, I think that people probably know you, like, or how they know you probably gives away their age. So listeners to the podcast who are in their late 40s or early 50s will know you from Spandau Ballet. People in their 30s and 40s will know you from EastEnders. And younger people probably know you as Roman's dad. What's it like having such a varied fan base, but also of such a varied career as well?
Listen, I've been blessed with my career, absolutely. You know, I've been going since I was 10 years old, and I did all of those 1970s TV shows like Play for Today and Comedy Playhouse, all of those things that you don't even know about. So, you know, I've been acting a long while, and to be inside that bubble called entertainment for what is 55 years nearly, it has been an absolute pleasure, because that bubble called entertainment that you're in as well is literally, you know, when I say this is literally our hobby, right? And as long as you remember that, then it's you can go anywhere with it. And back in the day, you know, when I first kind of left Spandau, it was a very difficult thing to cross from being an actor to a presenter to writing books. But as time has gone on, it's now an accepted thing to do. And I like to explore all the corners of that bubble.
Yeah, that's so true. It must be really nice for people in the industry to be able to jump around and do different things. And we talked to a lot of well-known people, you know, who are right in the thick of parenting, who are, you know, they've got babies and toddlers and, you know, they're right there kind of at the coalface. But you're out the other side. What wisdom can you pass on to us? I've got 5-year-old twins, so I feel like I am still at the coalface. What wisdom can you give us?
One is that you are always at the coalface.
Don't tell us that. We don't want to hear that.
it doesn't matter how old you are, it just changes. The dynamics change. But you are always there. The worry of having children, no matter how old they are, is always the same, right? But you just worry about different things. But I suppose if anything that I learned along the way, it was, and I think it's something that gets forgotten about a lot when you're parenting and when you're in the middle of it, and like you said, when you're in the coalface of them being a young people, is that you forget to listen. And listening is most probably the most important thing that any parent can show. Because a lot of times, you know, in our house, I refuse to have like the naughty step, and I refuse to tell them to go to their room without listening to their argument and without listening to what they had to say about it. Because a lot of the time, right, you'll be surprised that they're right. You know, they did just want to do that. And to them, it was really important. They did just want to build that last piece of Lego or whatever before dinner, and not get shouted at. I think that's the thing that I learned was the more you listen, the better your kids are.
It sounds like you and your wife Shirley were kind of ahead of the curve when it comes to parenting. I've seen you talk about how, you know, you treated your kids and probably still do treat your kids more like friends than the kind of traditional parent-child relationship. Where do you think that came from? I'm guessing there wasn't some parenting book back in the 90s that you were reading that was telling you how to do this stuff. Was it just like an instinct thing for you guys?
I think it was more from the fact that I wanted us four to become like a gang. And I think it was more from the fact that Shirley and I grew up from the age of like 17, 18 as being famous within bands. And so I think what happens is the older you get when you're famous is the more you want to pull the walls up and you pull you build the moat around yourself so that you and your family are safe. And I think that whole idea of us four becoming a gang was more from the fact that Shirley and I were well known, and that's how it started. But I think in the end it did us a favour, because what we achieved was the four of us became best friends.
Yeah, and it really shows, like when you see you talking with your kids and talking about your kids, that clearly has had a massive impact.
Oh, without a doubt, you know, and we all get on so well. But you know, I'm not saying my way was the right way. I'm saying there's lots of ways that are the right ways. It all depends what the personalities of your kids. But I think the overriding thing that I learned was to listen. And the more you listen and the more you just take a breath and sit back when your kids are screaming and shouting and just listen to their argument, sometimes they're right.
Were there points when they were perhaps teenagers where you felt that because of the way you were parenting them, perhaps they confided in you about things or they were honest about mistakes that they'd made?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was really true. But I would say that most of my kids are more honest and confided in my wife more than they did me.
That's interesting. You know,
I was always the one that was out working, and I was either doing a play or on tour with the band or doing something. And so I think my wife in the later years as they grew up became, especially when they were young teenagers, became their point of call for any problem. But, you know, I like to think that we have no embarrassment between us. We can talk about anything, whether it's, I don't know, girls or sex or whatever. You get any problems that they have, there's no embarrassment, and I like that.
That's good, yeah. You said that you're really close to them. Like, how often do you talk to them now, with them being, you know, grown-ups, not living with you? Neither of them live with you, right, I'm guessing?
No, neither of them do. But, you know, what I found is that girls always go back to their mum. They always want dinner with their mum, and they always want to confide in their mum. But boys are a lot more difficult to get home.
Yeah.
And I know that from growing up when I was a boy. You know, I wished I'd spend more time with my mum and dad. They're both gone now. But I wished I'd gone down and seen them more at their house. But boys have a tendency to go and see their parents less. And I know that from my girl and my boy, you know. That's why I end up working with Roman quite a lot, so that I get to see him.
Yeah.
You know, that's why. That is exactly why I started doing Gogglebox with Roman, was that I could see him.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And you've presented with him as well a couple of times, haven't you? You've done presenting shows with him.
Yeah, I've worked with Roman quite a lot. We've presented stuff together, and we did a couple of seasons where we did like 50 odd shows in a thing, but Breakfast with Martin Roman, that thing that we did. But I absolutely love working with him. He's an absolute perfectionist. He really is. And working with a perfectionist is good for me, you know, because sometimes I'm a little bit lazy and I try and find the easy routes around everything. And so I need a perfectionist to kick me up the backside every now and again.
Do you find yourself kind of falling into kind of dad and son roles when you're working together, or do you manage to kind of be quite professional about things?
We kind of, imagine a Venn diagram, right? Where I'm one side, the dad, and then Roman's the other side, the boy. And in the middle, you have that little slip of land that we are best mates. And I think we kind of like move between that Venn diagram all the time.
That's so good. Now, you mentioned right at the start about Christmas. You have everyone over to yours at Christmas. Set the scene for us. Tell us what the Kemp family Christmas get-together is like.
Okay, we wake up in the morning. I usually do breakfast on a Christmas morning, which is always scrambled eggs and smoked salmon. And then by about 2 o'clock, we sit down and have dinner. But we sit down and have dinner. Probably there will be 8 of us this year for dinner in the dining room that never gets used apart from Christmas Day. And so we have dinner in the dining room that smells of dust. And, you know, we cook a turkey that you can only just about fit into the oven, that is too big for anybody, more than you would ever need. And then we watch the Queen's speech at 3 o'clock, then everyone falls asleep, and then you wake up again to watch the movie. And after the movie, you have your pickle and cold turkey sandwiches. We are exactly...
It sounds exactly like my Christmas.
Exactly the same as everybody else. On Boxing Day, you will have your mash, your pickles and your cold meat. We're the same as everybody else. We do it. And that's what I think is really nice. Christmas is about, you know, I always find that Christmas and New Year's Eve is like putting a full stop on the end of the year. Mm. It's like the end of the sentence or the end of the paragraph where you get to breathe again before you start again. Yeah. And it's nice to take that break.
Yeah, and just to spend time, I guess, with your kids and just have that breathing space just to hang out with them, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, it's lovely. It's lovely, yeah. And, you know, the kids need it as well. You know, they need to touch base with their family. Yeah. It's a nice thing. You know, listen, my mum and dad are gone. Like I said, I wish to God I could go and see them. And so you got to make the most of it.
Yeah, you do. Now, we had Roman on as a guest on the Knit Mums podcast last year, and he spoke very openly with us about his experiences with his mental health. What's it like from a dad's point of view, watching your child go through struggles and hit such low places?
Yeah, it was a funny one, to be honest with you, because, like I said, Roman in his early teenage years would confide a lot more with his mum than he would with me. With me, he was all up and buoyant, and he was hiding it a lot more. And he was a lot more open with Shirley. And I knew he was doing that. And so when he was talking to me, I tried to keep him up and I tried to keep him buoyant. But obviously I saw moments in him that made me worry, I saw different things that affected him. But I loved the way now that he's turned it into something positive, and he's completely turned it on his head. He went through a terrible experience with his best friend committing suicide a while back, and he's grabbed onto that and made something good out of it. And I love Roman so much, because not because of what he's achieved in his career or what he's done on television, it's just about the person he is, and the man he is becoming is really nice.
And of course, we can't forget about your daughter, Harley Moon, because she's making waves, isn't she, in the country music scene. What advice have you and Shirley given her since you've both had such big success in the music industry?
You know, my advice to both of them, to be honest, and it's about life, really. It's something that I learned when I was in the band that I think is one of the most important things. is that every now and again, when you're young and your career's on this kind of like treadmill and it seems like it's going forever, you have to, when something really good happens, you have to stop and breathe it in, because you are in such a rush to get to the next place that you stop and you forget to breathe in when the good things happen. Like, for example, like when Spandau were playing at their height, it was, you know, I dreamt about being able to play at Hammersmith Odeon to 3,000 people. But when you get there, what you really want to do, play in Wembley Arena. Yeah. But by the time you get to Wembley Arena, what you really want to do is play in Wembley Stadium to 100,000 people. So you never stop and just say, you know what, Mark, this is great. Yeah. Just right now is great. And it's something that I've kind of made Harley and Roman aware of, and to breathe in the good times.
Yeah. That is really good advice for all of us, I think. And also, speaking of the music industry, we've got to mention you and Shirley being on The Masked Singer. What was that like? And did you really keep it a secret from your kids?
Oh, yeah, we kept it a secret from everyone. You know, it was bliss, to be honest with you, right? Because we got to put these masks on. No one knew who we were completely for 2 weeks, which, if you've grown up... being famous, right? If you've grown up with your face being known, well known, it is absolute relief for a couple of weeks of being able to wear a mask.
Yeah.
And it was a funny experience. And all I can say is, do you know if you're singing and you sing those big notes, you need to take in a big breath, right? Well, inside those masks, all you're breathing in is dust from the mask. And it's kind of like, where's the breath that you need? Where's the air? But me and Shirley had a lot of fun. And I absolutely love singing. I'm not great at it by any means, but I don't care. I love doing it. And it's something that most people forget to do, right? And it's kind of, it's good for your adrenaline. It's good for your endorphins. It's why we sing in church. It's why we sing, guys sing at football stadiums, yeah, is because they come out and they feel great afterwards. And I do this thing around the country where I DJ to 80s music. And we have about 1,000 people in the venues, and everybody, every single person is singing at the top of their lungs to every word they know. And it is, yeah, the most euphoric atmosphere I've ever been in. And it's because people forget how to sing at the top of their lungs. You know, everybody sings along with the radio, like half voice, quarter voice, but to sing at the top of your lungs, you feel incredible. So listen, I take any chance I can to be able to do that. Whether or not people like listening to it or not.
They do, Martin. So your debut novel, The Game, It is about a fallen 80s rock star who is dragged down into the underbelly of the East End. Now, I'm guessing that you weren't dragged down into any underbelly, but how much of it is inspired by your own experiences?
I think when you write a novel, I think all of those experiences that you put into any character, right, whether it's like you or not, is a big part of you. You know, I found that I was more honest about certain things in my life inside this piece of fiction than I was writing any biography that I've done in the past. There are emotions and dark things that happened to me that I really wouldn't like to explain within a biography. But inside different characters, you can put it in there.
It's a safer space, I guess, isn't it?
It's absolutely, I found it a really cathartic experience. I mean, but what you get to do within fiction is you make the highs a lot higher and the lows a lot lower. You know, the valleys and the troughs are so much bigger. So there's so much more fun that you can have with it. But it was something that always fascinated me. It was... when I was a kid, when I was growing up, and it terrified me, to be honest, in the middle of the 80s, 85, 86, when, you know, my face was on a lot of posters on bedroom walls. And I used to think, what happens if it all goes wrong. What happens if I'm left with absolutely zero, you know, back down to ground zero, nothing at all? And what happens then? All you're left with is a famous face. And how do you go back into normal life? And that was always a fear of mine. Where do you go? And it was something that I thought that's worth exploring within a book. And where would this guy go? And how would he get on? You know, sometimes your famous face is it does you a favour, and sometimes it's a hindrance.
That's so true. And how did you find the kind of the writing process? Because a lot of celebrities and famous and well-known people write books, and they use ghostwriters, or they have somebody who helps them write it. But you wrote all of this yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, but I think I grew up. When I was 10 years old, I was at drama club, drama school. And by the time I was 15, I'd done something like 30-odd television shows. And my brain was starting to work in pictures. And then after the band, I went off and I did the Cray Twin movie and getting back into acting. And I started to write film scripts. And then from film scripts, I was were turned into movies, so I was directing them. And then I started to write a load of biographies, which I have three or four by now. And I just thought it was the right time to write fiction. I knew I could write, you know, I knew I could do it. And it was just about, and I had this idea of the character for such a long time, because the character's name was the name that I used on the bad tags that would follow me around the world, the laminates that would follow me around the world when I was in Spandau. And it was like the pseudonym that I used to check into hotels with. So young fans didn't find you when they knew what hotel you were in. So the name was always there with me. And it was just about, it was more about putting it down on paper than it was about thinking of something brand new.
Yeah, but it still must be quite a different process, even to writing film scripts or the, you know, biographies that you've done in the past.
Yeah.
So, you know, hats off to you that you've managed to write such a brilliant book. It's not easy. Finally, Martin, what's next for you? Is there any stone left unturned? It feels like you have had a go and done brilliantly at so many things. Do you have any more novels in you? Would you like to write any more?
Well, I'm in the middle of writing the next one, the follow-up to this one, The Game, which is a weird experience because, you know, when I wrote The Game, it was I could take as much time as I wanted to. I didn't tell anyone that I really had it until much later.
No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. The second one, there's a time pressure, which I've never experienced before. And so that's something new for me to deal with. But I've already laid out the characters, I've already laid out the boundaries, so it's just about pushing it on. But I can't tell you, I have so much fun writing. You know, a lot of it comes from when, a lot of the ideas come from, I spent a long time out in Los Angeles. I lived out there for a few years in the middle of the 90s. And there was this thing called flotation tank. Do you know that? Right, where you get a little drop of salty water that is exactly the same temperature as your skin, which is the same temperature as your blood. And so you forget that you're floating in water. And all you're aware of is your imagination. So I find when I get in the bath of an evening, I can let my imagination run wild and go back to when I was in a flotation tank. And so as soon as I get in there, all the ideas for the book start coming out. And then I get out and I make notes on my phone. And within a couple of days, I've written them down.
That's brilliant. That's great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Martin. I feel like we have got creative writing tips from you. We've got parenting tips. We've got life advice, Christmas advice. It's the whole shebang. So it has been a joy to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.